Okay, so we're into our review session, and I want to make a few general comments before we start talking about specifics. The exam, it's next Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
which is kind of amazing. I don't know where this semester went, it's kind of it's flown by. The exam runs, let me think, it's 5 out of 6 questions. Okay, so two questions I'm always asked, general questions, number one, can I do 6? And the answer is no, don't waste your time, do 5, and that's it. If you do produce 6 answers, then there'll be a nice red line, or a green line, or blue line, or whatever line it is, going through the last one. I just won't grade it, I just don't have the time. I've got, I think, like 62 papers to grade, it's going to take me a long time. So, when it says answer 5, answer 5. Kind of obvious, but it needs to be said. Also, the order can be in any order, whichever you want to write. You don't want to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You can do 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, whatever order you want to do them. And be careful to read every section of every question. Most questions have like A and B and possibly A, B and C. Alright, section. So answer every section. You may not need to write so much, okay, but make sure that every section is answered. It would be very counterproductive to write a great answer on section A and miss out B and C, because you end up with a third of the points. Just doesn't work if you don't read through the question carefully. What I would say to you also is, and this is again one of my pet subjects, is the use of these blue books or pink books or white books or whatever color they put them in this year. Probably beige, I should think, is the color of the season. So you might find that they've got a different color. I really am not sure about that, but that was kind of a flat comment. Brittany, hi. Whatever color it is, please do not write on the cover. Please write in the book. Sounds obvious, but again, I had a wonderful student who decided to save paper, save trees. Very nice. So what did she do? Instead of writing the answer in a second book, she wrote it on the back cover, starting on the inside cover and finishing literally with 1 millimeter to go on the outside cover. Absolutely unacceptable presentation, and that does affect your grade. There is no question about that. So please don't do that. Even if you have one word, literally, to add, use a second or a third book, whatever number of books. Believe me, those books seem to reproduce quite amazingly. I have to speak to the bio people how these things reproduce so easily. Gillian, but seriously, it really is important for you to set out the questions clearly. If you can avoid sort of back writing two sides, maybe that might be a better way of doing it, but it doesn't really matter. Don't write in pink ink. Another thing that really bugs me from time to time. Somebody wrote a wonderful answer a few years ago, but she wrote it in pink or in bright, whatever color it was, which was very useful for me, because when I was trying to fall asleep one night, I could actually take a flashlight and read this thing under the covers. It was very exciting because it was glowing. The whole ink was glowing. But believe me, it's not really the way I usually like to grade things. If you can write, try and avoid writing in pencil. I would say bring a spare pen, always bring a spare whatever, and you know, do it the way it is meant to be done. Black ink, blue ink, but not pink, please. And that it goes for purple and all the other shades of interesting colors you might have. In terms of bringing books, I want to make it absolutely clear that this red book or pink book, those who have it, is not acceptable in the exam. But what is acceptable is any mikraot gedolot in Hebrew only, or a Hebrew-English translation of the text. In other words, if you have, for instance, a JPS or a Koran or whatever it may be, then I have absolutely no problem with you bringing that to the exam. In fact, I don't even have a problem with you highlighting parts of the text if you feel that that is going to be helpful or useful. All right. What I do want to see in the exam, it's really important, is use of the text. I don't need to see chunks of text, but what I do want to see is that every so often when you're answering a question, you do refer to the text. For instance, one example, if you're talking about Shimshon, then there's no way you can avoid talking about the Nevuah, the prophecy which was given about Shimshon, that he will be Shvifon Alidera, like a snake on the path. Alright? Shvifon is a snake which camouflages itself. This was the prophecy, the Nevuah. We spoke about it right at the beginning. And that's a phrase which is very useful to mention when you describe or talk about Shimshon. Alright? That's just, again, a little phrase, a catchphrase. It could be something, you know, whatever it may be, use of the text will always be something that I'm looking for, something that I want to encourage you to do. But not chunks. Don't start copying pages or whatever, sections. What I'm looking for essentially are pertinent phrases, relevant comments that you might be able to introduce into the essay that you're writing, either in Hebrew, and for those who find it difficult, write it in English. You know, give me a phrase or something, a comment in English. I really don't have a problem with that. Okay, so all of that is just by the way of technique. Okay, and again, this book, I'm sorry, is not acceptable in the exam, but anything else that you can lay your hands on of a translation, a straightforward translation, if you have an art scroll, the green, the big green one, which is also basically a translation, that's okay. If you have a JPS or you have a Koren, you know, there are a number of these translations, then please don't hesitate to bring. In fact, I would suggest please bring it to the exam. There are a number of them always in the Beit Midrash room upstairs. You know, wherever you can lay your hands on such a thing, please do so. All right? So far, so good. Any questions about that? Any comments? Yes.
Are you going to be here for the exam?
Please God, yes. I hope so. God willing. The exam is a 2-hour exam. The general experience is always that most people finish within, so an hour and a quarter to an hour and a half. That's the average time. Please don't try and do it too quickly. And as I always remind you, do not book your flight to wherever you're going, Las Vegas or wherever you're going, to celebrate that you finished your exam. Don't book that flight. Exam finishes at 3. I once had a student who told me she was flying to Israel at 5 in the evening. And she had to get to JFK. Very interesting sort of experience of going, leaving here and having to be at JFK at the same time, essentially, as she was doing the exam. She rushed the exam, wrote it in about 10 minutes, and really compromised her grade. It was not necessary, and nothing I could do about it. You know, I'm sure you're aware of this and hopefully plan accordingly. Yes.
Are we going to be able to go through the whole revision today?
Sorry, the...
Are you going to be able to go through the whole revision?
Yes, we are. That's our next port of call. We're going to go through the review sheet. I do have a few spares. I hope some all of you have your review sheet either on your computer or whatever.
Could I have one?
Hang on a second. I literally have 4 or 5. I need to keep one back. There you go. And we will go through the review section by section, blow by blow, or whatever way you want to describe it. Sorry?
People
do very well. Very well, but it does take a bit of preparation. It's not it's not a test that you can just sort of wing it. You really need to prepare. One final thing that I just need to mention
is...
Sorry?
Can I record you on my phone?
You can record me then. Excellent. One of the things that I... in terms of the papers that I've given you, I always keep a copy to myself of everything that I give out. And there are at least, I think there's like 15 to 20 handouts. So please make sure that you are very organized in terms of your handouts, that you've got all that stuff available for reviewing the material, because that's really, really important. We'll start going through this, and again, please sort of chip in as and when you can. Introduction to the Sefer and the period of the Judges. Now again, what is the most incredible thing about the period of the Judges, which hits you more or less at the beginning of the book? Right? The question that we raised right at the beginning of this semester. What is so, let's use the word, disturbing, shocking, can't think of any other word that I want to use, but you know, something that really is troubling us right from the beginning of the Sefer. Yeah.
The faith of
Israel. Excellent.
Like, it fluctuates.
What did we say about the timing? How many years after the giving of the Torah?
Yeah.
All right, just a second. What did we say? Sorry?
70?
Yeah, we said maybe this is 50, 70 years after the giving of the Torah. 28 years is the whole Sefer Yoshua. And you've got 40 years in the desert, so it's about 70 years after the giving of the Torah. So it's not long. 70 years is maybe two generations. And the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, we already see that the society is beginning to descend, is beginning to go down in its standard of religious observance. Basically, the issues that we see right at the beginning are the issues of, for instance, Avodah Zarah. Idolatry begins to catch on. And at the same time, and it's going to be something we're going to talk about in a minute, the whole question of intermarriage. But before we get to that, the whole period of the Judges, how did we describe it if I was drawing some sort of diagram on the board? How would I draw that diagram to describe the Judges? Yeah.
Is the circle?
Circle, not quite, but what sort of thing did we describe?
I guess that's fluctuating.
Yeah, it's like waves of the sea. As you go up, that means the generation is getting stronger, and then as you go down, the generation is getting weaker. And basically what happens is that the generation gets stronger, 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 it peaks, and they all seem to be very observant and connected to God. And then you see things getting progressively worse. They start having problems on the outside, the Canaanim, or the Moabites, or the Amorites, or whatever, whichever ite you can imagine, come along and start making trouble for Am Yisrael, and they get to a point where they are oppressed and they are in significant difficulty. And at that point, what happens is that Hashem sends through the auspices of the office of the leadership, the shofet, to bring them out of that particular depression. So basically, they get down to the bottom, the shofet comes along, and he brings the whole generation up again to the top of the curve. And this goes on again and again and again. They go down and up and down and up. And that's a very useful little diagram to represent the period of the Judges. All right. If you're listening carefully on this particular session, you will get lots of hints about things that you should take specific notice of. And I'm not going to tell you what the questions are, but it does become pretty obvious as we go along. Introduction to the Sefer and the period of the Judges. So again, that's basically what we're saying. How long was the period of the Judges? How many years did it last? Because that's an important piece of information. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, 300, a bit more. We say around 360, 370 years, right? And that was a long period of time. Most of that time, Am Yisrael was faithful to God. They were connected to Hashem. All right? They did not have this disconnect that we see from time to time. That was obviously problematic. But at the same time, for most of the period of the Judges, they had a shofet who would guide them not only in Torah Shebichtav, but also Torah Shebalpeh. That's one of the issues of the shofet we'll talk about in a minute. And that was the scene for most of the period of the Judges. I would say two-thirds of the time they were in a peaceful situation. One-third of the time, approximately one-third to one-half of the time, they were in trouble. All right, so that's the introduction to the Sefer and the period of the Judges and that diagram, the bumpy diagram, which, you know, however you want to present it, you can present it. Any questions, any comments? I hope that all makes sense so far. Number two, the differences between the judge and the king. All right, because here we're talking about a judge and not a king. Yeah. Sorry?
Kareem.
Again? I know what you said. I didn't hear it.
Deity.
Deity. What do you mean? What do you mean by deity?
What's,
I don't. I'm not sure what. Oh, dynasty you're talking about, not deity. Dynasty. Dynasty. There used to be a wonderful program on TV called Dynasty, but this is, your parents will remember it. It was one of the original soap opera programs called Dynasty. Great show. Remember Dynasty, because that's a major difference. Kings were involved with the concept of dynasty. Dynasty means it goes from father to son, and from father to son, and to son to son to son, etc., all the way down the line. The kings of Israel, particularly in the southern kingdom, when we're talking about David, and Shlomo, and then Rehoboam, and it goes on and on and on, this was father and son all the way to the end, to the Churban. Quite amazing. So therefore, we're talking about, in terms of kingship, dynastic element is really strong. In Judges, no. Judges did not have any concept of dynasty. They were literally, as you say, in the vernacular, a one-shot deal. Alright? They literally would be one and only, and we saw, just one second, I'll take a question in a second, and we saw that when they tried to do more than that, for instance, Abimelech in chapter 9 of Shoftim tries to take over from his father and turn it into a dynasty, it is a disaster. Eventually he's killed, and everything about what he does, he tries to wipe out the rest of the family. Remember, it's an absolute disaster. It's a terrible, terrible problem. Courtney, you had your hand up first, then I'll come over.
I was just going to say, the halakha of everything.
We're going to talk about that in a second, so hold that thought. Just the question here first, yeah.
Who is an example of that?
Avimelech. Now, he tried to make Judges, he was the son of Gidon. And he tried to make his situation into a dynasty, take over from his father. And basically, it was, for want of a better word, a disaster, right? It was absolutely... Nothing to write home about. It really wasn't. Well, in many ways it was, but differently. There's another hand floating around over here.
Otherwise, oh, it was the same question.
Same question. Good. The second point is Courtney's point. Just say it again. What was the law of the king as opposed to the judge? Excellent. For instance, how do you appoint a king? What do you do to him specifically?
Oil.
You take oil. You pour it on his head. All right. When it came to a judge, there was no such thing as anointing the judge with oil. You would not use the Shemen HaMishcha, special oil that was used. There is also laws regarding marriages. How many wives could a king marry? Yes. 18. Good number. Chai. How many wives could a judge marry? We're told about the judges. Pick a number and, you know, run with the number. Some of them married many, many more wives, and there was no limitation on the judges like there was on the king to marry only a specific number of wives. Also, in terms of horses and money, there were laws which were very restrictive on the kings, which did not apply to the judges. There were other things where they were exactly the same. And the best example of that is, of course, giving punishment. What is called Mored B'Malchut. If you rebelled against the king, you were punished directly by the king. The judge seems to have had the same power to do it. Alright? He could also put somebody to death. The idea of a rebel. If you rebelled against the king could decide your fate without reference to courts. Didn't have to go to court, didn't have to have witnesses. He was judge and jury rolled into one. Judges seemingly had a similar power. Alright? But what is very interesting is the type of court cases that they officiated over. Why do I say that? Because judges generally were doing different things to kings. What sort of thing did the judge officiate, whereas the king didn't? Yes?
The king only was concerned with big matters, he wouldn't come to him about small issues.
Excellent. But what sort of thing would the shofei deal with? Like arguments? Friends, neighbors, right? Neighborly dispute. You pushed your fence over into my property. They would go to the shofet, and the shofet would make a decision, all right? And he would have to decide between two supposed friendly neighbors who became very unfriendly because of a financial disagreement, whatever it may be.
So, saying that the judges had the small issues, like pushing claims to people's property, and the king had the bigger
king issues. Always dealt with bigger issues, matters of state. All right, and that is, again, a very major difference between the judge and the king. It's clear, if you think about it, that the period of judges was never meant to be permanent. The period of judges, by its very nature, if something is so temporary that it's literally only one person and it doesn't have a continuation, that in itself suggests a lack of continuity, a lack of permanence. It's not going to be around forever. If you've got a dynasty, the king is dead, long live the king, that is a permanent arrangement. But of course, the people were not yet ready for that permanence, and that's why they didn't have a king for the first 360, whatever years it was. Yeah?
When did we kind of transition from this idea of a judge to like the idea of rabbis?
Yeah, rabbis much later. We go from judges to kings. That's the first thing that we do. Rabbis, in terms of deciding issues or becoming teachers or whatever, much, much later development around the period of the Second Temple, and even not at the beginning, but towards the end of the Second Temple. And that's a different course. That's a completely different discussion. I can't talk about that now because that's much, much later, and that's after kings are basically gone. We don't have kings. We have rabbinic leadership, which is descended from kings. Right, what is called the, in those days they called them the Reish Galuta, the head of the exile, the Nasi, the prince in Israel. These were descended from King David, Rabban Gamliel, people like that, Hillel. These were all descendants, but they weren't kings. They were rabbis who were in a position of authority, and they could run things, but they weren't making the same, didn't have the same powers, for instance, as a king. All right, but that's much, much later. That's already 1,000 years down the line. Sorry? Before Islam, but it's getting into that kind of time frame. It's much, much later. That's an interesting question. All right, so that's number two. Differences between judges and kings. Look at your notes. There might be some more. I've got a feeling that we actually did go through maybe one or two more differences. We saw it on the handout, but we've covered the basic requirement in that particular discussion at the moment. Number three. The connection between intermarriage and idolatry is expressed by the Da'at Sofrim in his commentary. That was one of the handouts. And what did we say very simply? The big question in Perek chapter 2 and chapter 3 talks about intermarriage and idolatry connecting one to the other. How was the connection really made? So what did we say very simply? Correct.
Then somehow they pulled them forward.
They pulled them. How did that work? And Da'at Sofrim, Rabbi Rabinowitz, they converted them even when they married the non-Jewish women, and they converted them, but they didn't convert the families. They only converted the women to marry them initially. And the question is whether even that continued. But the thing that happened was that the families became connected. Exactly what the Torah warns you about and says, don't become connected to the society in which you're living. In Israel, right, initially they had to push them out, they had to destroy it, they didn't achieve the whole requirement that they were given, and the next thing you know, through this intermarriage, through marrying between the different sections of the society and the Jews that were there, there was a connection, a family connection. And what Rabbi Rabinowitz, the Da'at Sofrim, talks about particularly is a family gathering, right? It could have been the equivalent of Thanksgiving or whatever dinner celebration it was, and the families would come together, Jews and heathens, Jews and pagans, and the next thing you know, that the Jew would be invited back to go and spend a nice day at the local temple of idolatry. And of course, once you get to that point, the next stage of being involved with idolatry is very, very quick and quite difficult to pull yourself out of. So the suggestion is that intermarriage and idolatry were intrinsically connected. And again, look at that handout, there's a lot more to say, but that's basically the point as expressed in chapter 2, and if you want to add also the beginning of chapter 3. That's where we saw that particular comment, the first couple of chapters of Sefer Shoftim. Any comments or questions? Is it clear? family gatherings, what they call Hanukkah bush. This is I never came across this till I moved to the United States. Never had that in England because they really didn't go in for this stuff. But in this country, again, when you walk along Park Avenue, you'll see the menorah in one corner and the Christmas tree in the other corner. Fine. But many Jews today seem to believe in combining the holidays, and of course it really doesn't work. And it's a great problem in the society today. I don't want to get sidetracked on that, but that's basically where we're going. Number four. So far, I hope things are clear. Any questions? Otherwise, we're moving on. Number four. Othniel and Ehud. Storyline and insights. So again, what are we going to say about Othniel? Who was this gentleman? Who was he? Where did, you know, what was his position in amongst the Jewish people? What was his call to fame? Who was he the brother of? The brother-in-law of, yeah. Excellent. He was the brother of Kaleb ben Yefuneh. He was Othniel ben Kenaz. So of course, they're sons of two different fathers, but they have the same mother. That's the suggestion. All right. Othniel and Kaleb. And what is... Yeah, it's different fathers, but it's the same mother. And what is very interesting is, of course, Othniel's claim to fame. Somebody help me out here. What was his claim to fame? What did he do? What did he restore, revive in Am Yisrael, which was forgotten over a very specific period? Yeah. No, that was Ehud, that was the other guy. We'll come to him in a second. Othniel did not get involved, we're not told directly. He led an attack at one point, but he's much more famous for the spiritual side of what he was doing. Alright? There was a period of mourning for Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, remember, was a relative of Othniel ben Kenaz, because Kalev was married to Miriam, to Moshe's sister. So this was, Othniel was Kalev's brother, so you can work it out. He is Miriam's brother-in-law, and Moshe Rabbeinu, connected to Moshe Rabbeinu almost directly.
So what did
he do?
What did he revive?
Sorry? So what did he do? When Moshe died, there was a tremendous sense of mourning amongst Am Yisrael, to the point where they forgot 3,000 decisions that Moshe Rabbeinu had made. Nothing was written down. It was a Torah Shebal Peh. 3,000 halachot, which Moshe had... obviously decided through the course of the period during the desert, when one assumes this wasn't done in one day. You don't go through 3,000 in one day. And it was all forgotten. These were things that Moshe maybe had told one or two people here, one or two people there. Othniel knew them all. Everybody else in Am Yisrael maybe knew this one, some people knew that one, but because of the mourning, because of the grief that the people suffered, these laws were forgotten. And this was a serious problem. So what happened with Othniel, which is so amazing, is that he managed to restore all of these halachot. And that's what he's really famous for, a spiritual figure who managed to bring these halachot back into Jewish practice. Okay? And again, remember, the oral law was spoken, it wasn't written. So these were traditions which were oral, they were spoken. And Othniel represents the ultimate shofet, who is not only a military figure, but is actually a spiritual figure as well. Okay? Someone who literally transmitted Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah. Ehud, on the other hand, was a much more colorful character in many ways. Right? Why do I say that? Because, tell me a bit about Ehud. We learned a bit about him. Sorry? He killed a guy called Eglon. How was Ehud? What was Ehud's strength, weakness, which became a strength? Yeah. What happened was, one of his arms, I think it was his left arm, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh,
it was his right arm. Correct. Benjamin. Excellent. His right arm was not working. It was paralyzed from birth, more or less. And he couldn't use it. So what did he do? He turned his disadvantage, seeming disadvantage, a physical limitation, into an advantage to save Am Yisrael. Eglon, the king of Moab. Alright, remember, when you mention him, you can always link him to Ruth. Ruth was his granddaughter. Okay, and Eglon had one zechut. When Ehud comes to visit him to bring him a tribute, what happens?
He mentions God.
Ehud says, I'm coming on behalf of the God of Israel. And Eglon, as difficult as it was for him, he was really seriously obese, he managed to stand up. And at that point, the rabbis say that he deserved the reward. The reward obviously was that he had a granddaughter called Ruth, who became the grandmother, the great-grandmother of King David. So who is King David's great-great-great-grandfather? None other than Eglon, this king of Moab, one of the enemies of Israel. That in itself is quite remarkable, beyond remarkable. It's unbelievable. But that's the way it works. Ehud used his disadvantage. He hid his sword on the side of his cloak with the ark, which wasn't able to function, and he smuggled his sword into the palace of Eglon, and he asked for a private audience, and Eglon had no reason to suspect him. He particularly saw that he couldn't use his one arm, so he didn't think that Ehud would do anything to him, and Eglon made what is clearly a very, very fundamental mistake. Cost him his life. At that point, remember what happened, Ehud took his sword, drew his sword, and plunged it into the stomach of the king, and there is all the gory description that you would wish to read is found as to how the sword did not necessarily reappear. It disappeared into this guy's stomach. Every part of the sword, pretty gory. The question which I want you to think about, it says about Othniel, how many years of peace followed Othniel's reign, if you want to call it that?
I think it was
40, and Ehud, 80. So the question which I want you to think about, I'm not going to give you the answer, this is a thought-provoking question, is that who really was the greater judge? Was Othniel greater than Ehud because of his spiritual dimension, who he was, what he did in that particular area of restoring Jewish tradition to where it was before Moshe Rabbeinu died? Or was Ehud a greater person? Because at the end of the day, look at the story, the way that he used his disadvantage as an advantage. Unbelievable. Great, great role model for so many situations, that certainly things that we talk about today so much of. How to overcome disadvantages in one's personal circumstance. And more to the point, 80 years of Ehud, after Ehud died, was a time of peace. 80 years, double the time of Othniel. So the question will be, can we decide which one was the greater judge? That's something which I think you should think about, without giving away any sort of comment or direction. It's a thought for all of you to have. Yes?
What chapter was
All in chapter 3.
Very, very good.
Othniel was also chapter 3, although he is mentioned in chapter 1. Okay, very briefly. But the main element begins in chapter 3. Very good. Yeah.
So basically, about Ehud, it was that he was a military person.
Ehud was much more military. He led the troops, and he said, "Acharai, Lashem, you know, follow me for the sake of God." And the people followed him and managed to literally destroy the Moabites, who were very powerful. Okay, all of these victories, these military victories, were true miracles. They were remarkable. Yes, please.
Because
he stood up for the name of Hashem. One thing, good thing that he ever did in his life, and he got a reward, which almost sounds crazy, because he becomes the great whatever grandfather of the Mashiach. Alright, but that in itself is a whole discussion which I can't go into now. Why Mashiach has to descend like Eglon? You know, he's not the most obvious candidate to be a messianic grandparent. But on the other hand, there is a for those who have the art scroll Ruth, the introduction to the book of Ruth in the art scroll edition does give you a very excellent essay on that particular topic. Not something I can go through now, but for those of you who may be occupied over Shavuot, actually teaching or whatever, if some of you are, then that is a great subject to look at, because it does put the whole book of Ruth into perspective. It's something worth reading. Yeah.
I just have a general question about the final.
Yes.
So basically, it's like these 11 topics, or we have these 11 topics that are done in the class.
Right.
And there are six questions on the
correct.
Final.
Correct.
And so are some going to be like together or?
Well, the way it seems to work usually is that it goes by character or event, right?
Okay.
Some may cross lines, but for instance, question about Shimshon will be probably specific about Shimshon.
Right.
But more generic questions like the whole period of Shoftim,
right,
you can bring into the answer that question from all different parts of the scene.
Okay.
If you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But every question will have parts. There will usually be at least two, possibly three. You know, the sort of question I like is making a comment at the beginning, discuss.
Right.
If yes, yes, if no, no, why not, etc. So that sort of
right.
question.
Okay.
And it gives you a chance to present your fair hand in your fair hand of what you think. Okay. Please try and be legible. That's something I didn't mention, but it is kind of an obvious. I know there is a problem today that people don't necessarily, writing skills can be a bit challenging. And I appreciate the problem, but you know, the bottom line is that these exams still do exist. So give it a good shot. And if it takes a bit longer to make it legible, take the extra 5 minutes. It's worth it. Alright, I know what the idea of an exam is to get out as soon as you can, but take a bit longer, make it legible, and you know, you'll see that will produce hopefully a better result. That's number four. Number five, how are we doing? Yeah, we're good. Number five, Devar Ya'el, the Avera Lishma concept. Alright, this is something that we spoke about with Ya'el. Devara in the Shira Devara says, praises Ya'el, and we know that certainly midrashically we're told that Ya'el, in order to make Sisera, the enemy, the captain of the enemy of the Canaanim, come into the tent, she actually seduces him. And the question, of course, is how could she do that? Surely this is committing an act of immorality. So the whole issue of doing something, a sin for the sake of God, Avera Lishma. The Gemara puts it so bluntly, where the Gemara says that Avera Lishma, a sin for the sake of God, is greater than a mitzvah which is done not for the sake of God. In other words, when you do a mitzvah, you don't really think about it, or you do this Avera and you do think about it, the Avera for the sake of God is greater, is a more holy act. But we saw in the sources that there is clearly a definition which is required, and it normally is only allowed in cases where it will save the nation. It's in a national situation. It can be in a private circumstance, but it is something which affects Am Yisrael in the biggest sense. For instance, this story of Ya'el. Who is she killing? The enemy captain. If he's dead, then the enemy is defeated. This is something that she is doing on a private basis, but she is doing it to save Am Yisrael. Other examples of Avera Lishma, somebody help me out. What was one or two examples that we brought? Cases in Tanakh where we have this example, this concept of a sin for the sake of God, saving Am Yisrael. All right, there are one or two famous examples. Who made the fire come down from heaven, for instance? Yeah.
Shimshon, how he had to marry the woman.
Excellent. Shimshon is a great example, and we did speak about that because there is a whole debate: did he convert these women or not? And we can say that maybe he didn't, because he was planning, working on the principle of Avera Lishma for the sake of the Jewish people. He was saving Am Yisrael.
Shimshon married him.
Married the Philistine women. He was becoming camouflaged, the snake that was camouflaged on under the leaves, right? He was with the Philistine women in order to be part of their society so that he could attack them. And they would attack him and he would win, and Am Yisrael would be left alone. So again, that's a great example. Shimshon is a good example. There are other examples. I'll just come back to Shimshon in a second, but another example. Eliyahu on Mount Carmel, when he called the fire down from God. This was clearly an Avera. You're not allowed to make a sacrifice outside of the temple once the temple is built. But the rabbis explained that this was Lishma. This was specifically in order to destroy the prophets of Baal, the enemy Nevi'im, and the king of Israel at the time, Ahab, who was changing everything to idolatry, and Eliyahu was trying to really again save the Jewish people from the destruction which idolatry would bring upon them. So therefore again, Eliyahu, this is Malachim Aleph, chapter 17 and 18. Okay, and particularly chapter 18. Elio and Mount Carmel. Again, Avera Lishma. Yeah.
Do you think that it's possible to say that what Slachman did was
You can look at it like that, because he was trying to make a point for Am Yisrael by being Mechalel Shabbat, to show the seriousness of Shabbat. That's another example. There are many examples of this, but they've all got to have the same type of description, which is for the sake of Am Yisrael. It's got to have that bigger picture. If you're just doing it for your own gratification or whatever, not called Avirah Lishma, that's called Avirah, period. And that's a bad thing. Alright, so I hope that makes sense. I hope that's clear. Just to finish that particular line, Shira Devorah, the insights regarding her character. Many of you wrote about Devorah's character. She's not clearly warm and fuzzy. I will sort of put it that way. She does have a certain saita which is very tough. We spoke about modesty and leadership. That was the whole introduction to Devorah. The fact is that she lived a constant tension between, on the one hand, the issues of tzniut, which demanded a certain restraint. Right, Devorah has to be restrained. That's what Sniyut is about, the idea of not necessarily being in the position of authority, but to be in the position of power behind the scenes. Kvuda bat melech pnima, that famous phrase from Tehillim. David describes the glory of the Jewish woman as pnima. Pnima means to be behind the scenes. But yeah, sorry, kvuda bat melech, easy. Kavod, the same word, kvuda bat melech, the daughter of the king, pnima. As in the Hatikva, Panima. Okay? Kolo Baleva Panima. The glory of the Jewish woman is Panima, behind the scenes. So Devorah's got a problem. And the problem is that she's expected to lead from the front. She is the shofet. So we described, we also spoke about the fact that what sort of shofet was she? Was she a real shofet? What was the other option that she didn't actually make decisions, but what did she do? What was the expression that was used? Sorry? Yeah, go on. What was she actually a decider of law? Or was she...
An assistant,
right? Or she was a lecturer. She gave opinions, right? A legal assistant, paralegal. But was she a real judge? The rabbis have a problem. Because the reality is that the Torah limits judges and kings, both of them, only to men and not to women. All right? Melech velo malka. So how could Devorah be a judge? The answer is, she was either an exception to the rule, and for good reason, or we have to say that she wasn't actually a real judge. She was an advisor. She would make decisions, but she wasn't the ultimate word of being a judge. But of course, that's much more difficult to say, even though many rabbis do say it. Yes. And she was a Navi on top of that. I mean, to me, it's so obvious that this woman was such a powerful lady and such a serious, not just a serious leader in the military sense, but a serious leader in the spiritual sense, right? That there's no question. I mean, we asked the question that surely Pinchas was still around, he could have done the job. And she got the job over and above Pinchas. Shows how incredibly, you know, forceful and put together she must have really been. Okay, and this again is really, really important to understand the whole question of her leadership. So again, Devorah does create a certain amount of discussion, a lot of the things that we went through, review all of that, that's really useful. Number six, and we're getting there. Gidon testing Hashem. Alright, what's so unique about that? Very simple question that we can ask. Are you allowed to test Hashem? Serious question. I know that God tests us, but are we allowed to test God? Remember, what was the most obvious explanation? Was Gidon testing God? The answer was? Excellent. That's the Radak and the Rabbah. They'd say the same thing. That it wasn't Gidon testing God, but really testing himself. Is he really worthy of receiving all of this Siyata Dishmaya, all of the help that God was presenting him with? Alright? And Gidon is in doubt. He's not sure. And this is the question, this is the description we have of Gidon. Remember that phrase in the Rambam, Ma'amin Ve'eino Ma'amin. He's a believer and he's not a believer. Okay? He believes and he doesn't believe. He's like caught in the middle. He's not sure. He's the constant skeptic. And even when he succeeds, he's still not sure. right? He's already, you know, he's in a situation where God has said to him, you're going to win, you're going to win, you're going to win. He's still not sure. And of course, Hashem proves it to him by doing what? What is the famous part of the story? How many soldiers did he start off with in his particular army? Something like 32,000. How many was he left with in the end? Yeah, not even 700. How many was it? Famous number. All right, they even made a movie with the same title. 300. The 300, right? This is a famous film a few years ago. Different story, but maybe based on the original biblical, so I don't know. 300, that's all he was left with. And the idea was to say to Gideon, don't in any way, you know, minimize, or don't think that you're not worthy. Hashem will do a miracle for you. 300 of yours will wipe out the thousands and thousands and thousands of the Midianim, of the enemy soldiers who are fighting against you. What was the mistake that Gideon made at the end of his life, which is so dramatic and so difficult to explain? And that is, what did he leave behind? Ephod, right? He left behind an image. Some say it's a belt made out of gold, which would have been corresponding to one of the things that the Kohen used to wear. And this ephod was, even though it was done for purposes of trying to build up his tribe, remember, he came from a very lonely background. He felt that he wasn't worthy because he came from the tribe of Manasseh. He felt that Manasseh had been sidestepped from day one, right back to Yaakov Avinu. What did Yaakov do? He gave the bracha to Ephraim and not to Manasseh. So Manasseh always had a kind of inferiority complex. And Gideon reflected that. So he left behind a kind of monument to the victories that he had managed to achieve. And the trouble was that piece of gold or whatever it was became a source eventually of not praising God, but Avodah Zarah, became idolatrous. And that was very, very sad. And Gideon, of course, at the end it says he died, and it says an expression there which we found at the beginning of the Sefer, we find at the middle of the Sefer, and we find it again at the end. What was not done to Gideon the way it should have been done when he died? It says they didn't do chesed. That's a word that's got a feature in somewhere in one of your answers. The whole concept of chesed. The beginning of the Sefer, Yeshua died, no hespedim. They did not bury him with the correct formality. They didn't do the right speeches. They didn't do the right ceremony that was required when a king or when a leader died. That was the beginning of the Sefer. That was already a sign of something which was rotten. In the middle of the Sefer, when Gideon died again, the Pasuk says clearly, look it up, make sure that's one of the Psukim that you can refer to, the end of chapter 8, Perek Chet. It talks there about Chesed, that they did not do kindness to Gideon the way they should have done when he died. And of course, right at the end of the Sefer, where's the whole story gone completely out of control? And Chesed is not practiced at all. The famous story we learned last week of Plegesh Begiva, where Chesed seems to be in such short supply, it is quite shocking. Am Yisrael can descend to such a level where they won't even open their door to a stranger to give him a bit of shelter overnight. Instead, they want to actually attack and molest them. Unbelievable. So Chesed has gone completely out of control. Alright, so that again is very, very important element, not only of Gideon, but again of the whole of the book of of Shoftim. Number 7, we're getting there. Yiftach and the Neder. Yiftach sounds like a book by Roald Dahl, Yiftach and the Neder. What are we saying here? Yiftach and the Neder, what exactly was the problem? And what exactly became, you want to call it the solution? It really isn't a solution. What was the problem? Yeah.
He swore that whatever will come out of his house, that he was going to win, what he'll give it as a
clerk. Yeah, which of course, on the face of it, is a very positive thing to do, because it is a holy dedication to God. All right? Yeah, whatever comes out of his house, his promise was to dedicate the first thing that came out of his house to God as a sacrifice. Okay? The only problem was, yeah, sorry.
Did we skip Perek Tet?
Not that we skipped Perek Tet. I didn't bring it, we learned it, and we did talk about the idea of chesed, and that's really the element I wanted to bring up. Because again, the whole question of Perek 10, with Abimelech, and that whole story was, again, just to really develop the idea of a society where chesed is not being practiced. So that's as much as I want to say. I'm not going to sort of develop the Abimelech thing, because that's our whole issue by itself. But I brought it in only in terms of Gida. So your point is a good point. In terms of Yiftach and the Neder, he made a vow which really backfired. Because obviously what came out of his house? Who came out of his house? The first thing, his daughter, the terrible story. And there are two opinions what happened to his daughter. One opinion of the Ramban, Nachmanides. Alright, and what does he say? He says that in fact, what did Yiftach do? Shockingly, he actually killed her. He offered her as a sacrifice. Alright, he did a human sacrifice, which is very, very shocking. But the Ramban argues that that is absolutely what the Psukim are saying. The Psukim are not clear at the end of chapter 11. Those are the Psukim that you can debate. The other opinion of the Ibn Ezra, one of the great rabbis of the Middle Ages, is to say, impossible to suggest that he actually killed her, but what did he do? He sent her away to a secluded place, and she became, for want of a better word, an old spinster. She stayed there for the rest of her life. Very sad. The whole issue, of course, is about annulling the vow. Who could have annulled, who could have broken it, who could have reversed the situation? There was somebody available who could have done it. Pinchas, the Kohen Gadol. Alright, the Gadol Ador. So you've got Yiftach on the one hand, the judge, and you've got Pinchas, the Kohen Gadol. So we saw that in fact, because of various claims between them, and look at your notes on this, you'll see we spoke about this in great detail, neither did Yiftach feel that he should go to Pinchas. He was kind of below him. And what is shocking is that Pinchas also felt that he should not go to Yiftach. They should come to each other, but they didn't want to make the first move. Obviously, there was a bit of friction there, which expressed itself, sadly, in the consequence of the daughter's either being killed or being secluded for the rest of her life. What a tragedy. And again, this was part of the society. The suggestion was, why was Yiftach punished like this? Because, excuse me, in chapter 12, in Perek Yudbet, there is this story of Yiftach being very aggressive towards the tribe of Ephraim. Okay, for not joining in the battle, he basically kills 42,000, if I'm not mistaken, of the men of Ephraim as a sign of strength, you know, sort of going against them. Shibboleth, he managed to find out who they were, and that in itself was considered to be a very, very bad thing to do. And remember, Rav Levi suggests that that happened before the decision about Yiftach's daughter, and as a consequence that Yiftach was punished by the daughter coming out of the house because of the fact that the vow should never be made in the first place. Okay, I remember there was a lot of discussion about that particular topic. Any comments, any questions? We're going to move on. Time is of the essence. Number 8. So far, so good. Okay, I always find this lesson very humbling, I have to tell you. We're doing like 3 months in about an hour. It really is a very humbling experience. What I do get very excited about is the fact that we really did learn something quite major. I hope you come out of it feeling, wow, you know, that's a sefer of Tanakh that I did feel I really did learn something. All right, and stay with the program, and please go by the time you finish Stern. If you visit a few more of my classes, I'd like to believe you really come out with a very good working knowledge of Tanakh. I taught in a Sunday morning program, this is like 10 years ago, and a young man I met who went off to University of Texas, don't ask me what he was doing there, and I said to him, what are you majoring in? So he said, engineering. And I said, but he said to me, Rabbi, I was so enthralled with what we learned, and we didn't do it to any sort of level that we're doing it here. He said that he minored in Bible, he actually went to Bible study, right? And again, the University of Texas must have been a bit of a challenge to go in, but he said that he felt that he could handle it because he had a working knowledge of it, and when the teacher came out with something outrageous, which he felt was wrong, he would stand up and say so. He said, but don't you know what it says in Kings, you know, whatever? Because he felt that he really knew the Sefer, and that was very, very big encouragement to sort of hear something like that. And the idea is that, you know, it should be Torah Chayim, a living Torah, something you take away with you and that hopefully you'll remember for a long time. That was a little pep talk, but I always like that pep talk. All right, number 8, Shimshon, one-man army. What did we compare him to? If you wanted to sort of make that modern comparison, who was the gentleman that we spoke about? The Israeli spy, what was his name? Eli Cohen, somebody you should really should know about. It's still an ongoing situation in Israel after nearly 50 years that his body has never been returned to Israel. He managed to conceal himself in the highest echelons of Syrian society, and as a consequence he managed to find out many, many secrets which led to Israel winning that part of the Six-Day War by defeating the Syrians in such a comprehensive way. And it was down to him. And there are many comparisons. Again, Aveira Lishma, living that life of being amongst the Syrians was not necessarily a Jewish lifestyle in any sense of the word, but Lishma, really for the sake of Am Yisrael, for the sake of God. And this is a great hero whose body has never been returned to Israel. Just one of those very shocking things. The story of Shimshon in terms of being a one-man army. What was his philosophy? What was his plan? What did he decide to do? We spoke about this before. What was Shimshon doing which was unique in his approach to running the show? Yes.
Whatever he thought was right.
Yeah. He would follow the judgment that he would make through his seichel and through what he saw, through what he perceived. And of course, the idea was that he would be doing it on his own. He was given the ability to withstand the pressure of being in that non-Jewish society because of being born as a Nazir. He was born as a Nazir from literally before he was born. There was that fantastic chapter when his parents were told that he's going to be a very special young man who is a Nazir from birth. Nazirot Shimshon, never cut his hair, etc. At least not until the final situation. And of course at the same time he was given the spiritual dimension to be able to cope with being in that very, very difficult society, the Philistine society that he went into, literally enveloped himself, he married them, he lived amongst them, he played games with them, remember, he teased them, he had chidonim, he made puzzles and drove them a bit nuts, and whenever they rebelled against him, he took revenge on them, and he was able to keep them away from Am Yisrael. Even though the Plishtim were in the upper hand, they did not oppress Am Yisrael to any extent as they could have done if Shimshon did not do what he did. So Shimshon was really a remarkable man in his own right, trying to keep the Jewish people and the Plishtim far away from each other. And he succeeded for a very long time. What would we write on his epitaph? That means his obituary. What would we write on his tombstone? Here lies a man. How would we put it? Right? A great hero of the Jewish people. What would we say about him? On the one hand, yeah.
You could write that he was like self-sacrificing.
Excellent. But on the other hand, what was the danger? What exactly happened to him in the end? Became, what did we say? Remember that comment that we made? Rabbi Dessler talks about this. He became too
into the society.
Too into the society. And what about his own personal service of God? Too self-reliant on his own judgment. He felt that he could not get anything wrong. Everything he did was absolutely yashar. He thought that everything was correct. Became too reliant on his own ability to judge. And of course, by the end of the day, his ability was compromised, particularly by Delilah. The word Delilah comes from the word Delilah, Dalul or Dalil, which means to dilute, almost the same word as in English. She diluted his strength because she managed to influence him to take his mind away from what he should have been concentrating on, and he became more involved with her personally than he should have done. And of course the story in the end, remember that he's blinded that he is mocked by the Plishtim, but in the end he dies as a hero because he brings a destruction, the final destruction upon them, all on his own. His body is retrieved. Even though it was an effort to retrieve it, Am Yisrael retrieves his body because they recognize that what he did was not just for his own glory, but for the glory of the Jewish people. A great, great individual. Shvifon Ali Derek. That's the word to remember, or the phrase to remember, that it says in the story, I'll repeat in a second, it says when Yaakov gave a blessing to the tribe of Dan, which was the tribe of Shimshon, the blessing was Shvifon. Shin Pei Yud Pei Nun. Shvifon. He was going to be a snake. Alei Derech. Ayin Lamed Yud. Alei Derech. On the path. Alright? A snake meaning that it's an animal which camouflages itself in the dust. And that's exactly what Shimshon was going to become. A man who could camouflage. Don't ask me to spell the word camouflage because I always get it wrong. There's a U in there and there's some sort of A-G-E at the end, or A-U-G-E. You have to Google it, get the spelling. He camouflaged himself in the dust, meaning that he could hide himself in the society of the Plishtim. Eventually, they don't even call him Shimshon the Jew, they call him Shimshon the Tibni, right? Like the woman that he married, one of the wives came from Tibna. He was also called a man of Tibna. Tibni wasn't even recognized in the end as being of Jewish origin. He'd managed to camouflage himself so brilliantly. And as I said, the comparison to Eli Cohen is very strong. He also managed to camouflage himself in Syrian society in the modern age to the point where they saw that he was more Syrian than the Syrian. And this was a great achievement. Yeah, Ariel.
What was the first Hebrew quote that you used to describe him? Was that the Ali
Derech? Ali Derech, yes.
Was there something else, other term
you used? Yeah, I don't remember now what other term I used. Somebody wrote it down or whatever, but that's the one that really is the big thing. Shimshon Shvifon. Shvifon means like a sling, a grass snake or whatever. Sorry?
What chapter is that in?
Shvifon Ali Derech is found in Bereshit, chapter 49.
Okay. No, that's
Shimshon is in chapter 13 through 16. 13 through 16. Okay, we're almost out of time, so we have to just hop along to the next one, number 9. The final story, Pesach Micha Plegesh V'Givah, the impression on the whole period of Judges, how could these events take place? Idolatry followed by immorality. And of course, the whole question is, what's going on over here? And this is, again, reflecting at the end of the Sefer, as we explain, Shmuel HaNavi wrote the book of Judges to give messages, to give Musa, to give direction. And he was saying to the Jewish people, don't allow this type of negativity to take hold amongst the Jewish people because it led to disaster. Pesach Micha became a rebellion against God of idolatrous proportion, and Plegesh V'Givah became one of the worst examples of a small event in numbers, but became a civil war which decimated almost completely one of the tribes of the Jewish people. And this, of course, is there as a constant warning. We have to be super sensitive to these negative behaviors and to eradicate them as best we can. And of course, you know, look over again what we said about Plegesh V'Givah, the comparisons between that story and the story of Sodom. One of the big things we mentioned last week was the fact that Plegesh V'Givah, the discussion was it worse than Sodom? And the argument was made that maybe Sodom was still worse because in Sodom, the behavior was legalized. In Plegesh V'Givah, it was just a bunch of hooligans who behaved very badly. In Sodom, it was legalized attack of guests. Anyone who had a foreigner came into the country, it was legal for you, made legal to attack them, to rape them or whatever, and to make sure they never came back again. That is a pretty wicked society. So again, the whole issue of the last stories of the Sefer, referring back again to the issues of Chesed and the problems of the whole period of Judges. Number 10, the whole thing of Chesed is something that we've now spoken about. And I did say, and I really do believe this, that the Book of Ruth is this wonderful antidote. The Book of Ruth happens around the period of Judges. Ibtsan, one of the judges mentioned in chapter 12 of Sefer Shoftim, traditionally is Boaz. Boaz is the main man in the story of the Book of Ruth, And the story of Ruth, as simple and as plain as it seems, is all about one main issue, the issue of chesed. How to learn chesed. If we can't learn it from ourselves, then we have to learn it from the outside. We learn it from Ruth. We learn it from a convert who taught the whole of the Jewish people what the issue of chesed, how important it really is. Chesed on a small scale, and of course eventually chesed on a big scale. Alright? In other words, understanding that every act of chesed, as the Pasuk says, Olam chesed yibaneh, the world is built on acts of kindness. Okay, so that's all very important. And number 11, which is a bit of a repeat of number 1, background to the judges we've studied, Yiridata Dorot, describing the fact that as the generations went along, the generation got more and more Yirida, went down in spiritual level. Spiritual level, spiritual behavior, in the standards which the previous generation maintained, the next generation lost. Eventually it came to the point where you go from Sefer Shoftim to Sefer Shmuel, where the people say, enough, we're not going to continue this system of one-shot deals, we're going to have a king. Because a king, we hope, will guarantee a stronger presence of spiritual values, etc., in the Jewish people to keep Am Yisrael at a higher level than was seen during the period of judgment. And of course, that moves into the next Sefer, and that's obviously something that you look forward to when you get to Sefer Shmuel, to see the progression, to understand where we're going from Sefer Shoftim into Sefer Shmuel. Any final comments? Wow. And there it is. I hope it was working. Yes, please.
So, like, what you said for chapter 10, question 10 about, like, Ruth.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, if that was the question, like, what you said would be, like, enough? Like,
obviously to explain, give examples.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I think the Book of Ruth is so well known, not difficult to actually talk about.
What happens to
You'll have the Tanakh with you. That's the whole idea of bringing a Tanakh. That you may be able to, it's a very short book. And even if you read it through, it won't take you more than 5 minutes. Just hang on a second. Hang on 1 second. Before everybody leaves, before you go, one or two comments. Number one, just to say, I've taught Shoftim a number of times, but this group has been absolutely wonderful. You know, you're really, not only you're good listeners, we've been in this room, which has really been very, it's been cozy, let's put it that way. And maybe a bit too cozy in the sense that it does get a bit claustrophobic in it. But saying that, it's really been a joy, a pleasure to teach you guys, and I hope, look forward to seeing many of you as you progress through Stern. Those who are graduating, stay in touch when I see you. Please tell me what you're getting up to. I do meet occasionally at weddings or wherever. I see you guys. I really, really wish everybody lots of atzlacha and a great summer. I hope you have a really, really successful time.
Thank you.
And good luck in the exams. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.